Hello, dreamers, thinkers, and doers. Welcome to Ideate with Florian. In this season, we discover where good ideas come from, whether it's for a new feature, product, or company. I'm your host, Florian Hoornaert. For over 25 years, I work with small and medium-sized companies in engineering, sales, and management. During that time, I connected with many professionals to grow together. That makes me excited to explore the journeys of our guests with you. So let's dive in. Episode 2, the Forward Obsessed Founder with Pete Sina. In this episode of the Ideate with Florian podcast, we're joined by Pete Sina, founder of several companies and a so-called Forward Obsessed Founder. We discuss the intersection of creativity and business and how fascinating it is how this all comes together. Pete shares practical investor criteria like network effects and market arbitrage, learned from his own experience and mistakes, and he emphasizes the importance of singular focus in all kinds of businesses. We also discuss how Pete encourages breaking free from norms and how he likes to find value in combining different elements. The conversation ends with a call for self-awareness through the zone of genius. Listen to discover innovations in entrepreneurship, creativity, and business strategies with Pete. Pete, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I did a little bit of research on you, not in a creepy way, but in a positively obsessed way. And I found out that you are the Forward Obsessed Founder. And we're definitely going to talk about that as well. One thing that I found with you is that you're incredibly curious. You have a curiosity that seems unlimited.
Yeah, it gets people exhausted at times.
Ah, yeah, I think that you and I share that in common. You name yourself the Forward Obsessed Founder. So that means that you are an entrepreneur and you are the founder of not only one company, but a couple of companies, I believe.
Yes, I am. I guess the dictionary calls that a serial entrepreneur, but I don't call myself a serial entrepreneur usually.
So for you, what's the obsession? Where does that come from?
So for me, I just love being creative. And for me, creativity and business have always just came together for me in a special place. So I love living at the intersection of people, design, tech, and just how all those things work together. I just find it fascinating. And ultimately, that's what I think drew me to go on to start my first business. And then when I started to build that business up, I had other curiosities. I had other things I wanted to work on. I also think that a lot of my friends are entrepreneurs as well, big surprise. And a lot of us have this ADHD kind of shiny object syndrome, if you will. And I think for me, it's that curiosity that I think keeps me wanting to continue to consume and build. But then also, like, as I've gotten older and as I've built more businesses, what I've realized is that one business can't give you everything you need and want when you have that insatiable appetite for different types of businesses. And actually, it's better from a structural perspective sometimes, whether it's financial structure, team structure, or even just focus, to be able to create businesses that are really exist to do one thing. One of the things I say now is when I invest in businesses, I do a lot of angel investment, is I look for three things as an investor. I look for businesses that have network effects. I look for businesses that have marketplace arbitrage. And I look for things that have limited customization, keyword limited. You might be like, oh, Pete, that's an interesting three things. Like, what made you come up with that besides like a fancy book or something? And the short answer is I've just made a million mistakes over the years. And what I did with my first business was I was like, okay, it was a service business. It was a digital agency. So just to simplify it, I started a company in my dorm room. We did design development services. So mostly websites and apps and stuff like that. I don't want to over glorify it. And one of the things I realized with that was when you're in the agency business, the service business, the only way you scale that company is by adding more people. So then you're adding more revenue, but then in order to keep up with it, you have to add more expenses. That's the nature of a service business in general, unlike a software as a service business, which scales, you know, much better economics. So in doing that, I didn't have any network effects that were really sort of being able to permeate. And by network effects, I mean, you know, by virtue of doing one thing, another thing happens, right? So then as a result of it, I didn't have a two-sided marketplace, right? We think about marketplaces like Uber, Amazon. These are the ones that everyone knows about, but you can do marketplaces on a much smaller thing. And then as an agency, when your client says, hey, you know, can you give me an iced coffee? You know, before you know it, you start making iced coffee, right? And I'm being facetious a bit. But so then you end up getting into like hyper customization, which means that scaling it, training your people becomes very difficult. And I have lots of friends who are in agencies, you know, some are, you know, 2 people, some are 2,000 people. So it seems like it's a consistent thing. So what I said when I started to get into a place in my life where I could invest in new businesses is I wanted to create a thesis as to how I looked at a set of principles. So now when I invest in companies, I'm investing in companies that by definition have a singular focus, a singular purpose, and then they can limit the scope of how they deliver on that purpose by not being unfocused. And one of the things I think I learned over the years is that being unfocused is a big deterrent to reaching your goals and aspirations. So I hope that's helpful.
That sounds very logical. And how do you combine that then with, you mentioned the term ADHD. That seems very much to not combine with having a singular focus, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I've talked to a lot of people who, you know, there's different terms that we use today, you know, terms like neurodivergent or ADHD. Some people are saying just because we live in the distraction economy, everyone has the tendencies. I did tests for this stuff back in the day. So I know it's not just shiny object syndrome. But in all seriousness, I think what I've noticed about that tendency is there's patterns in the tendency, right? So to be specific, when you have ADHD, you're easily distracted, but also like when you find a way to learn that works for you, you can go all in on that. So I think a lot of times for me, the distraction is bringing me closer to creativity because I believe creativity is just connecting things, right? It's, you know, I think Steve Jobs famously said, creativity is just making uncommon connections or something. I forget the exact words he used, but I remember him saying it years ago, back when he was alive. But kind of going back, it's like when you look at the spider's web, you can, and you zoom out and zoom in, you can start to see the interconnections, and that's where creativity happens, right? That's where the remix happens and those kinds of things happen. So I think that you can look at that as a distraction, or you can look at that as a superpower. And if you're trying to sort of be laser focused on only one thing, it can be very difficult in some cases. So I'm just sort of speaking from my truth and my experience. I mean, obviously it's different for everyone, but I like to sort of use what some people might say is a weakness. For me, I think is a strength.
Right. So what I hear say as well, that the creativity and that shiny object, tracing the shiny object all the time, that is leads to creating a lot of ideas. But then at one point you have to choose and say, okay, this is the idea I'm going to focus all my energy up, and this is what I'm going to build the company around.
Yes.
And if I then have a second idea, I'm going to build a separate company around that. Is that?
Yeah. Well, in some cases, right? So I think sometimes things complement one another. Sometimes they can compete with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a good example is early on, we used to do a lot of software application development. And what we realized was that our core differentiator was really our thinking UI UX and the sort of front end aspect of it more than the enterprise, you know, ERP integration side of things. So I think really there, it's like you have to figure out then, like, so what does a CEO do at that point? You either build that capability, buy that capability, and by buy, I mean people, platform, talent, you know, whatever, or you partner. And I think that all of which can be successful, but they all come with different trade-offs. So I think that when you're trying to do everything, when you're everything to everyone, you're nothing to no one.
Yeah.
And that's where I think things get really diluted. And I made a lot of those mistakes over my career. And I think that what I've realized now is clarity and focus is a superpower. And just because it's not my superpower doesn't mean that I can't go and find people who have that as a superpower.
Right, right.
That's the magic, I think, of leadership versus like looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, okay, I am not this, but I am this. And I think you need that in an organization. And I'm really blessed in that I fairly recently, in the past couple of years, brought someone in to really help with that. And I think that we've started to already see the benefits of that in very big ways because I've got people now that are very strong where I'm weak, and I'm very strong where they might have that deficiency or not be great at that. So I think that complementary but competing skill sets is also helpful.
And then let's go back to like you're forward obsessed. What does it mean to be forward obsessed?
So I think what it means to be forward obsessed is for me, it's a mantra. So the reason I call myself the forward obsessed founder is that a lot of my clients are founders and CEOs. And what I try to do is I try to walk the talk. Right. There's a lot of people out there who are like gurus and coaches and everything. They've never been in the shoes. I've built a couple of different businesses. I've been a part of a lot of businesses. So I only come from a place of, if I'm going to give you a framework, it's a framework that I've personally used. I've watched success because that's the experience I can bring to the table, right? Versus like going in a book and saying, this is somebody else's framework. I've never tried it. I can't speak to the data on it or whatever. So to that end, Forward Obsessed for me is, it's about continuously innovating and iterating and experimenting, knowing that everything is always changing, right?
Right.
Change is the only constant. So for me, what that means is being a student for life, right? Constantly practicing curiosity and creativity in all aspects of my life, right? And I can go into details on all this if you want. What that means about being Forward Obsessed is like constantly learning, but also unlearning, right? Like what's something I learned 10 years ago that's no longer serving me today because the world has changed or I've changed or the problem has changed. So I think being Forward Obsessed means dedicating a growth mindset to all the work I do and understanding that that is going to continuously need to evolve and change. And that sounds probably pretty obvious to someone like you, Florian, who's pretty creative, but a lot of people, I think, don't apply that, right? They're like, okay, well, this is how I've always done it, so I'm going to keep doing it because getting me to this level has worked,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I sat down with somebody recently. They're an engineer, and I know you're an engineer yourself. So we were talking, and I said, well, how much are you using AI and large language models in developing software right now? And he's like, oh, those LLMs, they just produce crappy code. And I said, okay, well, let's do an experiment. We did an experiment together, and it was actually using GitHub Copilot. And I basically said, okay, let's write this piece of software. It was a React app. Okay, just to get specific, let's write a React app that just, you know, calls this API, gets this result set back, and then, you know, outputs it into this interface, right? Okay, we're going to build it. We're side by side. We're sitting together with our laptops. And how would you do it? And he walks me through it. And he's like, yeah, well, this will take X amount of time, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, here's how I would do it. So we both try to work with the AI. And he's like, see, it doesn't work. It doesn't know this library versus that. And I was like, no, watch this. And then I did a really specific prompt. You know, I want you to use this library. I want you to do this. Use this NPM package, blah, 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 blah. And I basically wrote the code in, well, the computer wrote the code. I just wrote the prompt for it.
Right.
But, and then I had to change like three or four things. But the point, I tell you that not to get in the weeds for the audience that might not be, you know, nerds like us, but I say that because if you think about an engineer, the greatest engineers that I know spend most of their time defining the problem and how they're going to solve it. And then a little bit of time writing the code because they write the code faster. Mediocre engineers or mediocre problem solvers, you know, just jump right into it and they just kind of like hack their way to the solution. I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but my point is, had we not been Forward Obsessed with that way, a year from now, 2 years from now, the next software engineers that are going to change the world, they're not going to ever know a time where they start from a blank IDE and there's not some kind of an assisted LLM or something in their workflow. It's just not going to happen, yeah. Right? So I use that as an example because if I wasn't Forward Obsessed, there's a lot of organizations out there that are not upskilling, that are not changing the way that they work. And I made that software example just, Florian, because I know you've got a background in software, right?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Yeah, you always have to be looking forward. Like, how can I get better at my job? How can I solve this problem better? And it doesn't really matter if you write software or do something else. It's a mindset of not being satisfied to the current status quo.
And people, I think, one of the things I say to people a lot is like faster, better, cheaper, right? Like everything's about faster, better, cheaper. And I think people sometimes get frustrated when they hear that because they think it's like a personal attack on them. Mm-hmm. But I think a good example is like faster, better, cheaper. Cell phones, right? Faster, better, cheaper. Hard drives, right? There was a time this hard drive was 4 terabytes. There was a time this thing would cost like $5,000, right? Now you can get this for like $75 on Amazon, right? So faster, better, cheaper, right? It's faster to produce and get it out in the market. It's less expensive, right? And it's better, right? In a lot of ways. So I think that we have to evolve the same way that we expect our products and our services to evolve, which is faster, better, cheaper. And I think the only way to do that is to be Forward Obsessed and to have that insatiable appetite where you're never satisfied with how you approach something. And there's always an opportunity to approach it with more skill or more craft or more rigor or more speed. So when I say Forward Obsessed, that's what I mean. So what I try to practice, Florian, with the work that I do, with the newsletter that I write, with all these things is, let me show the audience all the things that I'm learning that are working, all the things that are not working for me. Let me just put my mistakes out there, my successes out there, because no different than Edison in a lab doing thousands of experiments before the light bulb happens, it's producing that content and building in public and building in the open that I think makes for a Forward Obsessed founder. And I think that the next era of founders, I believe, are going to be emotionally intelligent. They're going to be experimentation heavy. and they're going to really foster cultures of innovation. And you can't have a culture of innovation without failure and experimentation. Failure has to happen in order for you to grow, to pick up a skill, to innovate a product, a service, whatever it is. And I think that's so obvious to people like you and me, right? It's so obvious maybe to you listening in the audience, but I see so many companies that do not get that right. And then they wonder, well, why can't we innovate? And I get, you know, some of my clients are Fortune 500 clients and they bring us in and they're like, Pete, how is it you and your team could do a half day workshop and our teams just change the way we think? And it's like, all we're doing is giving exposure to a new way to work for your team.
Yeah.
And then magically they're like, this is fun. This is successful. Let's do this. So nothing we're doing is brilliant here. It's just, we're just looking at it a little bit differently. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And it's interesting that I can correlate that with the other interviews I've done so far this season, where the word permission came up a few times. You have to give yourself permission to fail and give yourself permission to be creative and look at things different ways. So that totally resonates. So
100%.
I think so far we got a good image of who you are as a forward obsessed founder, what you can bring to the table. I want to bring this a little bit back to like the genesis of Digital Surgeons, your company. Just in a nutshell, where did you come from?
In the beginning, it was just me. I was a designer, coder, nerd, and still am to this day. And ultimately, I was getting hired by people to go in and fix their digital problems, right? So in the beginning days, that was, how do you do marketing on the internet, right? We just happen to call it digital. Now digital is like oxygen, we all breathe it. So in the beginning, I was the digital surgeon. I was getting brought in to fix somebody's broken code or launch a new feature or build this thing in a product or whatever it was. And ultimately, that's how it started. And then my dream was I just wanted to make cool shit for the internet. And that was just me as a young kid in my college dorm room at UConn, University of Connecticut, excuse me. And I did something that was very different back then that I didn't realize was different. And I learned this from my dad, which is when you say you're going to do something, do it.
That makes sense.
It makes super sense, right? But I had met a lot of people who they said they would do something and they didn't do it. So back then I was a kid and I told my boss or my client or whatever it was at the time, because it was different. I had freelancing and a job and the whole thing. They said, hey, can you build this thing? And I built it and we launched it and it got a lot of eyeballs on it, got a lot of traffic and it helped people make money. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. So I can click on these pixels and write these lines of source code. And now I'm helping businesses grow. And I started scratching my head saying, this business stuff sounds kind of interesting. And then the cooler the stuff we put on the internet, you know, at the time, a lot of interactive animated stuff on the internet. Flash was still cool back then. You know, now it's just all JavaScript and WebGL.
A long time ago, Flash.
Long time ago. No, 100%. The light hides the gray, right?
I know. I've got the same highlights. So.
yeah. Amen. Right. So then before you know it, there was more work than I could handle. So I hired a developer, you know, a friend of mine, and there's more work than I could handle. And then I hired a designer and there's more work than I can handle. And then I brought on a co-founder who was really, really, really talented with business development, sales. And I think what I learned from him back then was sales is the lifeblood of any organization. If you can't get customers, then ultimately you have a very big problem. So from that point, we just started adding and adding and adding. And then, you know, fast forward 20 years, now DS is sort of what we call Digital Surgeon for short. Now DS has become a company that's helping people transform their brands. You know, we're helping CMOs and founders create attractive foundations for their brand wherever the brand exists. And it happens to primarily live in digital channels, whether it's, you know, social or sites or apps or customer experiences. So that's how we've evolved over time. And now companies come to us and they say, okay, Digital Surgeons, help us tell our story, help us find and connect with our customers, and help us build our business and our brand. And that's what we've evolved into. And I consider myself really blessed to have the privilege and the opportunity to work with some incredible and amazing brands and clients and some incredible and amazing teams, you know, across the world. And that's how the times evolved. And I think now DS is just one of my businesses. I have a fantastic leadership team that's running that business on the day-to-day, and we continue to grow. And that's allowed me with my ADHD to find other opportunities to find, you know, most recently we launched a video production studio because we realized a lot of our clients needed more content. So I launched this video photo production studio and had one of the employees in our core company spin out and run that now. So I think ultimately what I'm looking to build now is a creative platform that helps people build businesses through the different lenses that people need for their business, whether that be creative, marketing, branding, recruiting, other services that go into building and growing a company. And now I'm trying to create small, independent hub and spoke businesses that all connect to one another and that could add multiple points of value to these organizations.
Is that what District is?
It's a great question. So District's the amalgamation of an idea that my co-founder and I had years ago, which was how can we bring together like and diverse minded people from different disciplines and industries and have them all working under one roof. So the original idea was being in Connecticut was not like being in New York or Silicon Valley back in the day. And we would look at each other and say, well, why is it I could go to New York and in Brooklyn, there was like a cool coffee shop that had like a designer. And if I threw my cup of coffee, it would hit a designer, an engineer, an architect, a photographer. I'm like, why didn't that exist here in Connecticut? And he and I were going back and forth. And at the time, we didn't know about this co-working thing. This was sort of before WeWork got cool and all that. And we had this idea. We didn't really do much with it. You know, we were two just broke young guys. And then through my partner's genius, because he's just the kind of guy who can just figure anything out in the real world, and I can figure anything out in the digital world. So together, we're pretty dangerous. And we figured out a way to basically buy an abandoned bus depot and turn it into a tech innovation campus. So what District is, to answer your question, is District is a tech innovation and entrepreneurship epicenter where we bring people together and give them a place to work, a place to connect, a place to have community and create those creative collisions. So on the campus, we've got the largest venture capital group in the state of Connecticut. On our campus, we've got a photo video studio. On our campus, we've got a co-working facility. Unlike WeWork, which leases the property, we own the property, which means we can control every aspect about the customer journey from how people check in down to how they connect with each other and all the events that are on the campus. So yes, to answer your question, that's what District became. And now as a result of it, it's created a flywheel. It's created an energy. It's created a community that allows us to force multiply these ideas that we have. And now new ideas are being kind of sparked and bred as a result of it. You know, my original co-founder is now expanding into cannabis and technology and new different ventures that have nothing to do with branding and marketing. But because we have that branding marketing superpower, we're able to apply that to all these subsequent subsidiary businesses that are interconnected. So I hope that answers your question, Florian.
Yes, absolutely. My geography is a little bit rusty, but I believe you're very close to New York City.
So we're about an hour and a half from New York City.
Okay.
Where we're located right now is a mile down the road from Yale University. So you might be familiar with those guys, yep. Just popular university, Ivy League, but yeah, so that's where we're at. And New Haven is directly between New York City and Boston. So it's a little over a 2.5 hour drive to Boston from where I'm sitting right now on my campus. And I can get to New York City right now, depending on the traffic, in about an hour and a half, either by train or by car.
And the fact that you're in the middle of those big cities, is that a benefit? Or how would your business have evolved if you were in New York City instead of just outside the city?
It's a great question. And I think if I tried to answer it now, it would just be speculation. Right. So what I would say is early in my career, my co-founder is actually from New York City. And in the early days, a lot of our clients were based in New York and a lot of our clients are still based in New York. The nice thing about the world we live in today is it's a bit of a boundaryless world now as a result of the post-COVID era. But what I would say is we've always worked with clients all over the world since the beginnings 20 years ago. So I can't speculate. You know, again, it'd be like saying, well, what if I opened my business in South Africa? Well, I don't know. Maybe it would have been different. But I'm super happy with it. I think what was a catalyst for me that I can only speak to just my own experiences, I think we attracted a different group of people as a result of where we're at. And I think that because there wasn't so much, like in New York City, right? You could throw a rock and hit 10 agencies. Mm-hmm. You could throw a rock and I'm just using a metaphor. I'm not trying to throw rocks at people, but but you know what I mean? Like the cluster and density of talent in high cities is there, right? So I think what New Haven did for us was it gave us an urban grit that was important, right? New Haven's like a mini city, kind of like Brooklyn. A lot of charm, a lot of character, a lot of culture here. But it created challenges, right? Like if I'm in New York, I could just spin up a meetup and 10 people show up that have the capability. But then you're also competing with the Googles, the Facebooks, the biggest companies in the world, which we always have and we always will. I think what's different is my partner and I have always figured out how to do more with less. Mm. And I think that when you can do more with less, you know, both of us grew up pretty modest means, you know, none of us kind of grew up with a silver spoon in our mouths. You know, we didn't have, you know, obviously I had privilege. He's the son of an immigrant, so he didn't have as much privilege as I had. But it's a long-winded way of saying that I think that not having a lot of money and not having direct access to the same kind of talent that the major metros have. New York, Silicon Valley, California, London, England. These epicenters have a lot more density of talent. It was harder for us to access those in the early years. So what I think it developed over the years for us was a deep desire to do more with less. And I think that resilience ultimately is what kept us forward obsessed over the years. And I can't tell you what it would have been like if we went a different route, because that would just be speculation. But what I can tell you, I definitely feel like I took away by being in a small city with a big heart here in New Haven, is what it really means to work hard to achieve your hopes and dreams. And not to say that people are different in different regions, but I hope that tracks. That's my story. That's the only thing I can share.
Yeah. Once you start that way, that's also how you probably end that way. And I mean, starting is as in the start of your career, and the ending is at the end of your career, and building the companies in between that you instill that in that company, right? So don't be satisfied, work hard. And as you said, do more with less.
The future of work is flexible. If you are being mandated to return to the office, fear not. There are things that you can do to create flexibility for yourself, and there are things that you can do to prepare for the inevitable flexibility that is coming your way. Collaboration Superpowers helps people and companies work better together from anywhere. And we've got a free remote working success kit to get you started. From personal user manuals to team agreements, virtual icebreakers, and more, download the Remote Working Success Kit at collaborationsuperpowers.com. We'll see you online.
With setting up districts and creating companies that are similar, that are complementary, in an interview that I watched from you, you used the word adjacencies. And you said, I believe in this thing called and. This power in connections. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Just first for the audience that might not have checked out that same interview, what I would say is all my life, people have tried to label me and put me in a box. And I think that you yourself, audience, might be feeling like someone's trying to put you in a box. And what I mean by that in my early career was like, Pete, you're going to be a developer, or you're going to be a designer, or you're going to be this. And I didn't like or, I liked and. You know, I was a really kind of shy, scrawny kid. I was very introverted, and I didn't want to just settle for one thing. And I also didn't want to bounce from job to job to job, because I think one of the problems with bouncing from job to job is that you never get to go past that depth point where you really get the value, right? Because there's that sort of like awkward, you know, clumsy year or two, but then you start to crack into like really the cheat codes happen, where the growth really happens. So for me, when I say and, it's I can be a designer and a developer and an entrepreneur and a father and a good friend. I don't have to choose being one or the other. And I think nowadays that the beauty of choice in the way we live our lives is that we don't have to just follow the rule book that someone's given us. You know, we all have agency in our own life to be able to make those decisions. And for me, that principle of and, you know, you can't see it because it's off camera, but I've got a lot of ampersands throughout my life. And the ampersand for me represents a couple different things. It represents collaboration. You often, when you see an ampersand used, it's, you know, Pete ampersand Florian, right? And it symbolizes a interconnection. So I could say Pete and Florian, or I could say Pete ampersand Florian. Typically, if you look at history, when the ampersand was used, it often referenced collaborations between different entities. And for me, collaboration, interconnectivity is where the magic happens. So as to your question about adjacencies, I believe that when you take things that are similar, like adjacency meaning like the line, right? So like you have a category here, you have a category here. What's the line? Often those lines, you know, whether it's the line on a seam where two things disconnect, the adjacency, if you will, or the adjacency of a category, it's that line that is a really magic thing if you dig deeper into it. And it's, I believe that when you connect different things together, uncommon connections happen. And my favorite example, just the audience might be being like, okay, what is this guy talking about? Is like, take your favorite music, right? If you look at the top 40, you know, music right now, it's a blend of different genres from different people from different backgrounds. You know, 10 years ago, you'd never hear rap music and dance music together. Right. Now all you hear is rap and dance music together, yeah, right? Yeah. Just music.
And for the older folks, if you combine opera and rock, you get Queen. right?
There you go.
That's, yeah.
100%, right? But what that does for us is that creates novelty. Mm. And novelty in the brain then unlocks dopamine and all these different feel-good chemicals, right? So the reason why, like, I consider myself a designer in my life, right? Where, and you see the products that I have behind me, they're all well-designed. They all have interesting stories to them. So when I talk about how to find adjacencies, what I always like to look at is find the friction, right? So find the unmet need that people have. And the way to do that is just pay attention. Listen to what people love, listen to what people hate, listen to the discourse, watch where people get confused or frustrated. It could be like, if you're out in public, it could be trolling Reddit, scraping review sites, whatever you want to do. That's where those adjacencies start to pop up. And a good example of adjacencies is I found that, like, every year we were continuously being asked to do all this video content. And we could have just hired people internally to do that work. We could have hired contractors to do that work or hired other companies. But what I realized was it wasn't that we needed just another video thing. It was that there was a deep need in the community to be able to do storytelling that happened to be video. So what I realized is that that adjacency between video and digital wasn't just about making videos, wasn't just about making digital things. It's about how do you bring those two things together, right? So that's where combining technology with combining the ability to capture content, magical things start to happen, right? So when you think about the adjacency at scale of what that means, look at Vimeo, look at YouTube, right? Very successful companies. And ultimately, all they did is they combined two separate things. Video's been around for 100 years or 60 years, right? The internet's been around for a long time. Smashing those two things together and creating a portable player, now you have YouTube, now you have Vimeo, now you have tools like this. So when I say adjacencies, that's what I mean by it's combining different things that don't naturally overlap and understanding that when they do overlap, new magic things start to emerge from that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It also reminds me of a quote from Lucien Boehm. He's the chairman of the Dutch Startup Association, and I interviewed him for the last season. He says that human needs will always be the same. If you look at, like, the basic human needs that we have, that our parents had, that our grandparents had, that they have, like, 4 or 5 generations before us. But through innovation, we constantly find new ways to fulfill them. And I guess that's also what you're saying, that video was not new, but then the internet was a new medium to express that video. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I very much agree with that quote from that person that you interviewed, for sure.
And if you find the next big thing, and I'm switching to a next topic now a little bit, if you find that next big thing, does that mean that you are the best person to pursue that? And I'm asking that in the context of the light bulb green zone moment, which I allow you to explain that.
Well, first, let me answer the question. I don't believe that every person that comes up with the idea is always the best person to bring that idea to life. I just think that's fact, right? I think that ideas are nothing without execution. I've been saying that for a long time. And I think that not every idea that hits us is one that we should take forward, right? Sometimes we're not the right person to take it forward. Sometimes it's not the right time. Timing is everything, I think, in life and business. And then sometimes we just don't have the things that we need. You know, my favorite example is like the Star Wars movie, right? Like, George Lucas had the idea for Star Wars movie long before he actually made the movie Star Wars. And same thing for James Cameron's Avatar movie, right? Like, I think in a lot of cases, that's the way that I would look at ideas. So for me, I want to just separate the two, because I think light bulb moments are when something hits us and we all know what that feels like, right? Green zone is a concept that I've curated from a lot of other thinking and frameworks around this idea of what is your zone of genius, right? So zone of genius was based on a book, I believe, called The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks, if my memory suits me correctly. And what he basically described with the zone of genius is, what is the thing that gives you energy, that lights you up, that also brings you joy and fulfillment, that you're also really good at? So one of the things he breaks down in this book, it's a great book, I highly recommend it. But if you don't want to read the book, I'll give you this sort of cliff notes. I wrote this article called, you know, Green Zones, which you're referencing. And ultimately what it comes down to is we have a zone of incompetence, like the things we're not good at. We have a zone of, like, ignorance or things we don't know about. We have, you know, a zone of competence, things that we're good at, but maybe we don't love those things, right? Maybe just because we're good at it doesn't mean that we love it and we want to do it. That happens a lot as we sort of grow in our careers, no matter what it is. The zone of genius is sort of this intersection of what's the stuff that you're really good at, that you really love to do, and that really lights you up. And I think that that's a really important thing to realize. I see that with a lot of founders, that they have a thing that lights them up, going from 0 to 1, as Peter Thiel talks about. And when they get to a point of scale, then they want to step back. And it's really better at that point for another CEO to come in and scale the company. And why I say that specifically just is because I do a lot of work with founders. So I think it tracks for me. It's my how I spend a lot of my time. But that zone of genius is finding it means that the most important thing we can know is ourselves. And you have to have high self-awareness if you're going to, in my opinion, the best person to know is yourself. Because then from there, you can develop emotional intelligence. You can develop boundaries. You can develop these systems. And these are things that I'm sharing them now with so much passion. But like even just a couple of years ago, I had no clue on how they worked. So one of the things I do now with all of the people that I coach, whether they're employees that work for me or that are running my companies or clients that I'm serving, is I sit down and do this exercise with them and I ask them, what is their zone of genius? And there's a set of questions that I have them go through. First thing I have them do is a time audit, where's all their time going? And then just with a highlighter, you know, if you want to print it out, you can also do it digitally or on your phone. But like, what's the, like, okay, you just did a thing, mark it green as it gives you energy, mark it yellow or orange, it's taking your energy, but like not too much, or mark it red, like it just sucks your soul dry. Right. So I'll give you a perfect example of it. One of the things recently, I was working with a CTO and he's responsible for a very big software product. I can't say which one, but you might have heard of it. And he was spending a lot of his time in meetings and it was taking him away from his magic superpower, his own genius, which is really building these like scalable architectures, right? They recently took this really big monolithic framework, broke it down into a series of microservices, which totally created scale for the company. It was really amazing. And what I realized was he had these limiting beliefs around needing to meet with his teams. So I said, okay, well, what would happen if you didn't meet? And he's like, well, then we wouldn't stay in touch. I'm like, well, what would happen if you could stay in touch? He's like, well, if I could just like put some thoughts down and get those out to people and they could hear my passion and my thoughts, then that would help. And I said, well, that's amazing. Do you think you could do that for me right now in 5 minutes? And he's like, yeah. And I said, okay, well, let's start using a tool called Loom. And you're going to just record notes and you're going to put them in a Slack channel and your product managers can see it and they can make sure that your teams and everything are able to do that. And then instead of you having to be in these long meetings, you can do it that way. Would that serve your needs? And he's like, oh my God, yes. Now what we found is he's sending on average 1 to 2 looms a day that are 5 to 7 minutes long, right? So now instead of him spending an hour every day, which is like an hour and a half a day in meetings and then the fatigue from switching from thing to thing, he's saving like 8 hours a week. And that 8 hours, as we know as engineers, is like focus for him to be able to really think about the bigger picture problems. So now he's happier, yep, right, through that coaching session because he found his zone of genius and he leaned into it, right? But again, first you got to start with where you're at right now, what's taking your time and energy, and what gets scheduled gets done. And I think we can either let our schedules schedule us or we can schedule our schedules. So that's how I would answer the green zone. And for me, what my green zone is being at the center of how all the things can get come together, right? What I've realized is I might not be the best drummer or the best guitarist or the best coder, but playing the orchestra is something that I have a lot of love for, right? Because I've been a coder, I've been a designer, I've done that work in deep totality for many years. Now I can sit back and I can look at how these things come together with deep empathy for the people who are like master craftsmen and women in their roles. And I can sort of play the orchestra in a way that is more about directing the energy and attention than it is writing every line of code or pushing every pixel or looking at every spreadsheet. And that to me is how I found my green zone and started to double down on it. And I think what that turned into for me is my businesses were more successful. I was happier. And ultimately, I think I was a better person to be around both personally and professionally because of that. So that's what worked for me. I'm not saying it's what would work for you, but I do think that what everyone can benefit from is a little bit more self-awareness as to where they're at in their journey and where they're headed next.
Yeah, I did read your blog post about the green zone. And I did indeed, afterwards, after a week, go back to my calendar and mark, like, what did I do in that week? First that, have clarity on what am I do? And then mark everything green that I really liked and marked red but just sucked my energy. And then the rest was orange. And just knowing what I like, what gives me energy. Because if I can stumble upon an idea, but I know it's going to take me into my red zone instead of my green zone, I will not be the right person to execute it. So that was very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. The other question I do have about the things that we talked about, like getting ideas, executing on them, being visionary. You also mentioned this in the introduction before that you get ideas, you're really visionary with forward thinking. You found a co-founder who is more business development person.
Yeah.
I think there's a book called Rocket Fuel which describes this as a visionary versus an integrator.
Yep.
What if you're an integrator? And I see myself more as an integrator. How do I get groundbreaking ideas?
The first question I would ask is, why do you think that you need groundbreaking ideas?
Yeah, because I do think that's what I like about your forward obsession is that everything has already been done, but you have to think about how am I going to do it better? What's the next big thing? You know, that's what we're chasing, aren't we?
Yeah. So I think what you're referring to is a book called Rocket Fuel. I love that book. And the author in that book talks about this idea of visionaries and integrators. And the visionary is sort of the one that comes up with the big idea and manages the big relationships. And then the integrator is the person that kind of brings together the people and gets all of the work done. And I think that there's a misconception with that book. And I'm actually curious to see if he was to write that book today, I'm curious to see how much that book would be different. So I think that the problem that I would first say is, I think a lot of people don't realize the importance of an integrator. Integrators are actually more rare to find. You know, there's a lot of people that run around that are creating ideas. I think that like I've had to be in the job seat of a visionary and an integrator. And by visionary and integrator, I mean, read the book. I'm not calling myself a visionary and integrator. I'm saying the book describes these roles and what they do. So I want to be very clear with the audience. But so I believe that right now we've sort of gotten a little bit drunk on this idea that we always have to be coming up with the big idea. And sometimes I think it's the small idea that is the big idea. And what I mean by that specifically is like, I'd be willing to bet if me and you spent 90 minutes together and you walked me through some of your superpowers, the different technologies that you work in, the things that you've built in your career, I'd be willing to bet that there's a small idea staring right in front of you that we could get some energy around that would scale. So I think that right now, the problem that I see is there's this, everyone talks about the big idea. And the reality is we can look at Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, all the FANG companies. We can look at some of the biggest companies in the world, and they didn't all start out as a big idea. You know, like I wanted to get a girlfriend, so I built this application, and I was mad that I couldn't get a girlfriend, so I built this application called Hot or Not or whatever it was called, Face Mash. And then I got a lot of shit, and then I was like, oh, I want to connect with people. I'm really a disconnected person and I'm a good coder. Let me build a little thing that we now call a social network. And that's Mark Zuckerberg's story, right?
Right.
We can look at Facebook or Meta today, like this magical company, but it really started out as someone just doing something that they knew and loved. And all the companies started that way, right? It was like a rebel spirit that wants to make computers differently and a passion for making computers. And let's take on the big blue IBM. And that company was called Apple. So I think that the thing that people often glamorize or dramatize, in my opinion, is the big idea. And I actually think the big idea today is the small idea and really focusing on that. So what I would say as an integrator is I have such a deep respect and empathy for you because the integrators are the ones that get the shit done. And every company needs an integrator. I'm wondering if every company needs a visionary. And I'm asking, you know, again, I have been blessed in that I've had to wear both hats. And I think I've done both jobs mediocre at times. And, you know, every once in a while, I've done good at one of them. But it's hard to be both. And I do think that you need aspects of both. But I also think that some of the fastest growing companies out there on the planet that have multi-billion dollar valuations start out as a small idea. Started out as a small itch, right? You think about the developer that built Figma, which just got recently acquired by Adobe, right?
Mm-hmm.
The pain point was, why can't we design together in a way where we can be in the same file at once? Pretty basic premise, right? Not like this big, crazy, transformative idea, but he went on and he prototyped that as an engineer and, you know, figured out a way to like get WebGL to do some incredible stuff in the browser. And then before you know it, we have Figma. And now everyone's moving off of Sketch or everyone's moving off of Adobe or all the different products, XD, this one, that. And everyone wants to be on the cool kid platform. It had energy, right?
Right.
Figma had energy in the early days. And now we see what it's become. So I think you can start from a small problem that a lot of people have. And if you can show people that transformation, you can really take it over the gap in a big way. So I hope that answers your question. If nothing else for you, as someone that I think might have the big idea right in front of you, it just might not feel big just yet.
That is very encouraging words for you. And I thank you for that. And that going into the weekend, because we're recording on a Friday afternoon for me, that is definitely something to mull over. Like you don't have to, perhaps don't even know that you got the big idea. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg didn't know they had the big idea. It was really something small that he did in his campus and that turned into something bigger that you could not have imagined before.
Do something different that people don't know that they need or want until they need or want it. And that's the thing. And the best thing to do, in my opinion, again, I've read a lot of case studies. I can only speak for my experiences, and then I can only speak for the knowledge that I've picked up by watching other successful people and sometimes being one of those, again, sometimes, is ultimately at the most simple level, you have to create a transformation in someone's life that when you've done it, their eyes light up. And it could be as simple as like watching people on the street trying to hail a taxi cab in the middle of a busy street in New York City, getting rained on, soaking wet, when they just want to get home to their family, and saying, you know what? Maybe there's a better way for me to be able to use my skills as an app developer to build an app that can pair people who are looking for work, drivers, people who are looking to push a button, and now something like Uber can be born. So right. I think sometimes it's finding that thing. Sometimes it's also just looking at like, look at your code, right? Like you're a developer, you're an engineer, you're like, look at all the code that you've written in the past 5 years, look at what problems it solved, and ask yourself the question of how do I take this enterprise engineering background that I have and apply it to a small business or a local business that doesn't have that thing, you know, look for problems. And what I would say is problems will find you if you look deep enough, right? My favorite place to hang out used to be coffee shops in busy cities, and just watching how people will fumble with something, right? Like, remember years ago, I was in a Starbucks coffee shop and I was watching someone fumble on their wallet trying to find, you know, the dollars and cents, whatever. And then they were like, pulled out their credit card and they paid for the coffee. And I was saying to myself, it's so annoying to be able to have to like pull your credit card out every time. And I kicked myself because I'm like, shit, like, I had done work with credit card systems before.
Right.
So I knew like authorize.net and gateways and stuff like that. Had I just got together with the right people and came up with a mobile payment terminal that I just started small, like I could have gone on to start, you know, this crazy thing. So I kick myself sometimes because those are things that I thought about, but instead of following that idea, I was probably sitting in my red zone doing things I shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And if I had just followed that idea, then maybe I could have created mobile payments or something like that. So that's where I think that people don't hold enough space. It's a big mistake I've made in my career is I haven't held enough space for myself to think and dream about the problems that I have because I was too busy being in my business and not working on my business. And what I would say is whether you're an individual contributor, a manager, a leader, an entrepreneur, make sure you hold space, even an hour a week, to just step outside of the machine and look at the machine. And I think the machine itself has a lot of clues, and you know, success lays clues.
That makes a lot of sense, and I think that's the closure of this episode. Thank you very much for sharing that. That is jam-packed with insights, this interview, I have to say. Thank you.
I mean, again, I can only share my experiences. I hope they were valuable for people. And again, if anybody has any questions or clarifications, please feel free to reach out to me. I'm pretty vocal on social media, and I'm just Pete Senna everywhere. If folks want to check out the stuff I'm writing about, I'm on Medium quite a bit at Pete Senna. I'm still on Twitter for the foreseeable future, even though who knows what's going to turn into it with X Elon stuff.
Yeah.
And I just love this stuff. I love connecting with smart people, creative people that want to change the world and, you know, one line of code or one product or one thing at a time. So happy to connect. Love this stuff and super passionate about it and love what you're doing, Florian. So thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you very much, Pete. And there you have it, another inspiring episode of the Ideate with Florian podcast. As always, I encourage you to visit our website at ideatewithflorian.com. That is ideatewithflorian.com. Here you will find links related to this episode as well as other episodes. My name is Florian Hornaert, and I hope the story inspired you. Thank you for joining me, and until next time.